طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. In the spring of 2017, the Palestinian Solidarity Committee at Harvard held a forum on campus featuring Palestinian and other voices exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation. Time will not permit us to bring you the entire forum, but you will hear two of the voices, Nadia Ben-Youssef and Rhonda Wabe, and their presentations will fill all the time we have this morning. Nadia Ben-Youssef is an attorney and the U.S. staff representative of the Palestinian Legal Defense Organization, Adala, headquartered in Haifa. Rhonda Wabe is a PhD student in anthropology at Harvard, focusing her research on the effects of settler colonialism in the West Bank, and is the former international advocacy coordinator for ADAMIR, the Palestinian Prisoner Support Organization. We begin with Nadia Ben-Youssef, followed by Rhonda Wabe.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for inviting me and for hosting this conversation, which is really an interesting one. And even the title of it, I think, is quite compelling, idea of prisoners, incarceration, and illegality broadly. And so I hope we get into some discussions, not only about Israel-Palestine, but as kind of we move this discussion, I think it would be a nice progression into a larger conversation about these issues globally. I want to start with an anecdote and then kind of move on to a presentation. But I was recently in Palestine, and I was in Aida Camp in Bethlehem, and I was walking around. I was trying to do laundry or something, and there was a group of young boys who were going to tell me where to go to get my laundry done. And they were just chatting with me about what I was doing and asked, like, where are you here? What are you doing? And I said I was a lawyer. And they said, oh, for prison? For prisoners? And I said, well, I work for a human rights organization, and we do some work in prisons. And they all said, there were four of them, and they were between the ages of 12 and 14. And the one said, my father is in prison. And the other said, my uncle is in prison. And the last one said, our classmate was just taken, and he was taken while we were there. A young 13-year-old boy was kidnapped at night and then held in detention. And they were immediately, one after the other, were talking about, and I've never had, obviously, in this, even in the United States, where you have communities who are facing and whose reality and daily reality is about incarceration and about social control in similar ways to Palestinians, I've never had a child who said, what do you do? I'm a lawyer. Say, for prisoners? It's not something that happens. It's not a conversation that happens. It is a reality for Palestinians in an important way. And I think when we start looking at systems of social control, and that's what I'll say, kind of looking at incarceration and criminalizing populations, you start getting a sense of what's going on with the state. And so I think it's a really useful lens to see what are the interests, what are the fears of the state, and though we're going to focus on Israel a bit, and we'll move into Mexico as well, but we start thinking a bit more about just tools of oppressive regimes and how they work. So I was I actually rarely do this, but I was trying to stick within 10 minutes, so I have 10 minutes of things to tell you. But I'm one of the things I'm often asked, in even when we're talking about whatever it is, whatever system or issue of oppression we're talking about, home demolitions or incarceration, or why Palestine? Why am I focusing on Palestine? What do I think is useful about Palestine? And I have to say that Israel offers us a very painful and transparent expression of state power and the way that colonial legal regimes work. And I think when you're looking particularly at incarceration and imprisonment and captivity as a tool of empire, as a tool of the state, Palestine tells us something really important about how oppression works and how these systems and these structures are inevitable outcomes of states and systems that are founded on this lie or the myth of supremacy. You will find this in situations of oppression all around the world. If there is a lie of supremacy, in the case of Israel, of Jewish supremacy, if there's a lie in this country of white supremacy, and the institutions are founded on that lie, you're going to have this result. You're going to have criminalization of existence, of the non-valued members of that community. You're going to have, you know, all of these things that we'll discuss soon. So I just want to offer that the reason we think about Palestine and the reason why it's very edifying, it's an instructive thing for us as those of us who care about justice, who care about social change, is that it tells us the story very clearly. What's going on? What is the state thinking when it's going through these processes? So what I'm going to do over the next few minutes, you're going to keep me on time?
Yeah.
Do I have like 2 minutes left?
Nope, you
okay,
have
enough.
6 or 7.
All right. Just to walk through a bit of history of Palestinian citizens of Israel in particular. So Adana, Fatima said that it were the legal center for Arab minority rights in Israel, founded primarily to focus on the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And I want to use the law, so we're a legal center, we use the law to protect and promote the rights of Palestinians, but I want to use the law to explore what that says about the state, the sort of laws that are being passed. What is deemed illegal or criminal is really instructive in the case of Palestinian existence and resistance. And I think it's also important just in terms of how law works, really. Like, I like that this framing was prison, incarceration, and illegality is the topic of the panel. Like, what is deemed legal? Who is writing the laws that say that X or Y or Z is illegal? I think it's important for us to keep thinking about this, and then how it transfers into our own realities. So I'm going to talk about what Israeli law tells us about the state, and then the ways, just some examples of how the law is used to facilitate, one, subjugation, and I think what's more important is how it limits resistance. So what is being criminalized in Palestine, and why you have mass incarceration of Palestinian people, what's being criminalized is, one, existence, and two, resistance. So the laws that are being passed, that have been passed, that have defined the relationship between Israel and Palestinians since the establishment of the state, since the Nakba, have all been about reducing the power of Palestinians. How do we limit their power? How do we control them? How do we control their resistance? So, lastly, I'm just going to close on how we might, as a larger community, overcome that, and how Israel is using those same tools today. So, in broad sum, I'm talking to a quite versed audience, but maybe you'll learn something useful, or even in the way that the narrative is presented, and you can push back if it's wrong, and you can raise your hand if you want me to stop. But basically, I want to just talk about Palestinian citizens of Israel broadly. So, we understand who Palestinian citizens of Israel are. Palestinians are descendants, Palestinian citizens of Israel, descendants of Palestinians who, after the Nakba, after the catastrophe of 1948, when the state of Israel was established, remained in their homeland and overnight became what we call homeland minority, became a minority in their own land. So the vast majority of Palestinians became refugees when Israel was established. 750,000 people fled, were forced to flee. 500 villages were destroyed. The Nakba. If everyone's familiar with the word Nakba, we're going to remember it, and we're going to say it because it's going to come up again soon. Became refugees. 150,000 people stayed. 150,000 people stayed within the borders of the new state of Israel, and in 1952 were granted citizenship. Were granted citizenship. You're welcome, citizenship, to these 150,000 people who remained. But they lived under a military regime until 1966. And I want to talk about the military regime because it's important as we kind of move through this conversation of how similar means and methods of social control, including incarceration, but not only incarceration, were transferred, so it's important. Military regime from 1948 till 1966. What happens in 1967? Brenda is going to talk about what happens in 1967, 50 years ago, and how that's being transferred and how the military structure is being transferred to the OPT, the Occupied Palestinian Territory, and also kind of coming back. But so the military regime, what did that mean? Probably all can know well what a military regime means, not only because we know something about Israel-Palestine, but because we were probably here in the United States, some of us, in 2014, when there were tanks on the streets of Ferguson, if you remember. There were curfews. What does a military regime look like? Oftentimes when I'm speaking to a different kind of audience, when I say military regime, they know what military regime is because they live it in their communities. In the United States, curfews, militarized policing, police surveillance, in certain communities, communities of color, black and brown communities, know exactly what I'm talking about without having to know anything about what's going on in Palestine. But a military regime meant, of course, restrictions on freedom of movements, closed military zones, permit structures, administrative detention, which Renda will talk a bit about. And essentially what was happening during the military regime is that the presence of Palestinians in the state was defined as illegal. So all these emergency regulations, so it was illegal to resist the confiscation of land, it was illegal to resist fragmentation of your community, so it was not possible to communicate with Palestinians in the West Bank. It was illegal to resist, you know, what was happening with regard to the denial of Palestinian refugees to return, so to aid in that was illegal. So Palestinians, the resistance of Palestinians to the military regime and to the new reality of a colonial state of Israel being planted on top of their homeland, any resistance to that was criminalized. So it's super important to think about the way that the law is used to say that this particular behavior is criminal. Your particular behavior is criminal. I would recommend at this point Professor Shira Robinson's book, Citizen Stranger, who looks at the military regime very closely. So the military regime was transferred in 1967, that Randa will talk about, but even when the military regime is lifted in 1967, the relationship between the state and Palestinian citizens is unchanged, essentially. So these people, though they are citizens, and we can talk in another lecture about what kind of citizenship Palestinians have, but though they were citizens, they're still viewed as security threats. That there's something about our relationship that requires me to have a very different relationship to you than to other citizens of the state, and in this case, the Jewish citizens of the state. So the military regime is lifted, but you're still being limited in pursuing rights to land, to planning, your social economic rights, certainly civil and political rights. And when it's necessary, when the state needs to take it away, the state takes it away. The state takes away your rights. So your rights are conditional. And so just a few examples. 100,000 Palestinian Bedouin citizens of Israel live currently in the Nakab in tens of what are called unrecognized villages. So this is another idea about the law as a tool of the powerful to say what is or is not legal. So villages that existed before the state of Israel, when the state of Israel was brought upon historic Palestine, the land was declared state land by law. The land is now state land. The people who are on the land are trespassers. You're on state land. The state, it became state land yesterday. But today, you're trespassers. So who writes the laws become very important in terms of what practices or what is becoming or deemed criminal. And so there are now over 50 laws in Israel that discriminate against Palestinians. And again, they're tools of social control. And they're tools particularly, and I think it's important also for student activists, to stifle dissent, to stifle resistance. And what I hope is happening is not something that we're thinking really about Israel-Palestine, but that when we're reflecting on these issues, we're thinking about ourselves. We're thinking about the reality of law in this country and the way that the law is used, who it's written by, what interests are being protected, and that we're challenging the institution of law as an institution that is driven by an ideology of supremacy. An ideology in this country of white supremacy, an ideology in Israel of Jewish supremacy. And so the law reflects that, right? So what's being done and what is being stifled and who benefits from the law? So just a few examples. So was that?
Yeah, no problem.
2011, we saw a wave of discriminatory laws. So there's over 50 discriminatory laws on the books that discriminate against Palestinian citizens of Israel and Palestinians living under occupation. But I want to just touch on a few so we start thinking about what's being criminalized and what will bring you into the to the incarceration system. So 2011, the Nakba law. So we talked about the Nakba. We know what the Nakba is, the Nakba, the catastrophe. 2011, a law is passed that says if you're a public institution, your funding will be stripped if you commemorate the Nakba. The Nakba is coming up May 15. Libraries, theaters, universities, if you commemorate the establishment of the State of Israel as a day of mourning rather than as the day of independence, your public funding will be stripped. Memory is criminalized. Narrative and history is criminalized. That same year, Israel passed the Admissions Committee law. Admissions committees operate in 43% of all towns in Israel, 65% of rural communities, and basically says that we can let you in or not on the basis of whether you are socially suitable. So that means Palestinians are not allowed in, it means that the wrong kind of Jews are not allowed in, Mizrahi Sephardic Jews, Ethiopian Jews, single families, you can do all sorts of things, but if you're not socially suitable, we're not letting you in. Segregation and exclusion is legal. The boycott law, which we can talk about extensively here as well, made calling for a boycott a new civil tort. So a new civil wrong where you could be sued if you called for a boycott. Dissent is criminalized. And in the last couple of years, there's been a huge crackdown, particularly on the resistance of young people. Thinking about young people in particular, where is the strength of the resistance? And the strength of the resistance, whether in Palestine, in Mexico, in the United States, is led by young people. The spirit of resistance is led by young people. The vision of the world that they want is led by young people. So how can we stifle that? Last couple of years, if you remember in 2015, there was what was known as the knife intifada, or the third intifada, where there were stabbings and there were issues and there were all sorts of new laws that were allowing shoot-to-kill policies. It became legal to shoot on suspicion and to kill on suspicion. There were minimum sentences for stone throwing. So you know that the throwing of the stones and the model of resistance that's was being criminalized. And so there was unlike any other law and any other crime in Israel, suddenly there was no discretion of the courts and there were minimum sentences for these little kids or fines on the parents of stone throwers. So inside or outside of prison, and maybe in the Q&A, if there's more time, we can talk about what's going on in prisons, but I think that we'll talk about it a lot. We have to think about the role of the law in limiting resistance. And I want to just end with another anecdote, which shows kind of where I think the next stage is going and why these sort of conversations are very important. and why thinking more broadly about this issue is the latest kind of threat, is the strength of the resistance. So I was in interrogation on my way to on my way into Ben Gurion Airport. If anyone's been to Ben Gurion Airport and you have a particular name or look, you know the Arab Room. So in the Arab Room, there I was in the Arab Room.
And there's, there's a Latino room too.
There's a Latino room. The brown room. Yeah. The brown and Latino. Gabriel, Mahmoud, like everybody's there. So we're sitting in the Arab Room and I'm waiting for the interrogation, and I go into the first interrogation, the second, and then you know, and the second interrogation gets a little bit more intense. In the second interrogation, a man named Jason is talking to me. So Jason, which, why is your name Jason? So they're like, where do you come from? I don't understand. With a very strong American accent. But so Jason is talking to me about normal, like, where are you from? What are you doing? What's your father's name? What's your grandfather's name? What are you doing in Palestine? What are you doing in Israel? What are you, what's the situation? What's Adala? Everything that you, and then you know there's a certain moment when the interrogation becomes serious. Right? So you're talking, and then it's kind of like nice, and then you don't actually, it's like weird, it's interrogation, but it's, there's a moment where it happens, where there's either the books are closed or the computer is moved and they look at you differently. And in the past 7 years, since I've been working with Adela and being in the Arab Room situation, was in the past, the moment that happened, it was about who do you know that's organizing protests? Have you been in confrontation with the military? Who do you know in the political movements? Who's organizing on the ground? What's going on with the proper plan in the Naqab? Who's, you know, what's happening? Trying to get who's doing the direct action and the resistance. Maybe three years ago, around the boycott law stuff, it started, BDS became a huge issue, right? So are you engaged in BDS? What are you doing with BDS? This time, get this, Jason says, Jason's talking. Jason puts his book down and he said, tell me about intersectionality. Like this. This black feminist thought of like, and Kimberly Crenshaw, and he was like, that's not what I mean. We think it's extremely problematic, this idea that you're linking struggles that have nothing to do with each other, and it's, the government, thinks that it's a false comparison and that it's going to lead to nowhere. And he got crazy. He literally lost his mind over intersectionality. And I think that that's a reflection of why we need to move in a very different direction in terms of our struggle. And you guys know that. Students know that. And you're dealing with this issue very differently. So a panel on incarceration can't just be about Palestine. It has to focus on Mexico. It has to focus on the incarceration of black and brown bodies in the United States. It has to be broader than that. That's where the threat is. When we start thinking of these systems as interlinked and we start recognizing that our role in the struggle is about reaching out to each other and creating a mass movement, that's what's scaring them now. So I would just encourage you, as they're trying to limit resistance, this is what they're trying to limit. Do not stop reaching out. I'm so proud of students who are doing this now. And I'll stop. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi everyone, my name is Lorenza. So today I'm going to, thank you Nadia, that was incredible. And I'm going to take from where you left off to 1967. I worked with an organization called Ad-Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Organization based in Ramallah. It was started about 30 years ago now, and the organization's primary role is to provide legal aid to Palestinian political prisoners. So exactly like what Nadia experienced in Aida camp, that was the type of work that we did. And so I'm also really happy that this panel is happening right now, especially because the 17th on Monday is Palestinian Political Prisoners Day. It's an annual event that happens to honor and commemorate the political prisoners and also to show support for their families who have often been stranded by political factions, by the political leadership as well. So the issue of incarceration and the issue of prisoners is one that is central to Palestinians, and especially for liberation and justice and for us to see any type of solution in Palestine. Since 1967, there's been over 800,000 Palestinians that have been arrested by the Israeli occupying forces, which is one in every five Palestinians and 40% of the male population. Mm-hmm. So this situation affects every single family, every single person, just as Nadia explained right now. You can meet anyone in Palestine and they will tell you about a parent, a sibling, a friend that has been arrested at one point. They have probably seen someone being arrested at a checkpoint, experienced it in their own homes, and it is really something that has become prolific and really invaded every part of Palestinian intimate life. Just to take off a little bit about the military orders, so there's 1,600 military orders that govern every aspect of life in the West Bank, is exactly for the reasons that Nadia described, in order to control and suppress any kind of resistance. So, for example, every single political party is actually considered illegal, including Fatah, who are the Palestinian leadership that the Israeli government negotiates with. They are actually considered an illegal party. Gatherings of people are outlawed as well. The Israeli military governor can make any space in the West Bank a closed military zone at any instance. And we have some people who are on the Harvard Palestine trek here who can tell you that when we were in Palestine, we were on a bus a couple weeks ago or a month ago now, and the Israeli military saw us there, and they actually called that. They immediately said that was a closed military zone, and we were stuck on that bus for 2 or 3 hours because they had deemed it a closed military zone. Now, had we been Palestinians, many of us would have been arrested, probably. And that's just the reality that we live under there. Even traffic violations are criminalized under military law. Because the Israeli military controls all of the roads that connect the Palestinian cities in the West Bank, they often pull over Palestinians because Palestinians have different license plates than Israelis. Palestinians have white and green license plates. Israeli citizens have yellow license plates, so it's very easy to find a Palestinian and I'm blanking on that word. What is it? Racially profiled Palestinians on the roads. So, for example, if you're pulled over for speeding, if you're pulled over for not putting on your blinker, for going over the yellow lanes, obviously you can tell I haven't driven in a long time. I don't even know what these things are. You can potentially go to prison, and you will be fined. And so we see that there's an Israeli military industrial complex where incarceration is very closely tied to making money for the Israeli government. So 2 years ago, the Israeli military court actually published a report to say like how many people had been arrested for traffic violations, how much the fines that were incurred, and it was actually 3 million shekels, so almost $1 million worth of fines that were paid by Palestinians into the Israeli military courts. This excludes Palestinians who are arrested for under all of the other military orders, who also pay fines in addition to serving sentences. So today, what I want to talk about, because we only have 10 minutes, and obviously we could talk about this for days, is on the 17th, on Palestinian Prisoners' Day, there's actually going to be the launch of a mass hunger strike. And we haven't had a mass hunger strike among Palestinians for several years now because of the intense repression and attacks that the prisoners face when they go on hunger strike. When I was working in Ramallah, there were several hunger strikes of both individuals and mass hunger and collective strikes, in which they faced severe repression, everything from beating, from being put into solitary confinement, from being transferred to different prisons, from being shackled, from being... sometimes they would tell us in the affidavits that they would dangle the force-feeding tubes in front of them to tell them that they would force-feed them, even though technically force-feeding is illegal. And maybe Nadia can talk about the legalities of that in the Q&A, because Adala was working on this legislation, against this legislation. So this is a really important and crucial moment where Palestinian prisoners need support, because without having solidarity, they will be left alone in the prisons. And actually, even sometimes when upon their release, they tell us when they come to our office that the soldiers, when they put them in the guards, when they put them in isolation or are beating them, tell them, no one even knows you're on hunger strike. We can kill you right now and no one will know. This is the level of repression that they're facing when they go on hunger strike. So this is a huge deal, and we need everyone's support here for the hunger strike. So just to give you some context, right now there's 6,300 Palestinians that are in Israeli prisons. 500 of them are under administrative detention, meaning they're being held without charge and without trial. There's 300 children in prison and 61 women that are in prison. So I'm going to talk about a couple of key issues and then talk about the demands that of the prisoners. So there's 13 demands that the prisoners have created collectively that revolve around five different themes. One of them is for the resumption of family visits, which are currently on hold, for improved health care, for improved transportation and the end to solitary confinement, for access to education, and for the end of administrative detention. Hold on. How much time do I have?
About 4 minutes.
Oh, God. Okay. All right. I'm going to skip that page. So let me just get straight into the demands and why they're really important. So this hunger strike is basically calling for improved conditions because of how horrific the conditions are in prison. Oftentimes, there's at least 8 prisoners to a cell with 1 bathroom. They're extremely overcrowded. They're extremely filthy. They're all actually considered against international law because all of the prisons are inside of Israel or in historic Palestine, making them impossible for the families to be able to visit them without having permission both from the prison and from the state, because the state considers them entering into Israel. So the first demand and the most important demand is for the resumption of family visits. Can you go over 2 slides?
2 slides?
Yeah, next one.
This one?
Keep going. Here. Oh, yeah.
Back. Sorry, this one?
Actually, yeah, they're out of order, it seems.
Okay. Keep going.
No, keep it on that one. Okay, so the reason this family visits are so important is because this is the only form of support for the prisoners, and this is a way for the Israeli occupation to try to break resilience of the prisoners by keeping them away from their family. Oftentimes they hear, because family visits have been revoked, they oftentimes hear the news of what's happened if someone got married, if someone was born, if someone died in their family. They hear about it months later because they're not allowed to see their family, or they hear it through other people. So this is oftentimes the first line of punishment for prisoners, is to revoke family visits. And they do it in 2 different ways. So sometimes they will say the prisoner is fined for some reason, for maybe acting up in the prison or for starting a hunger strike. So they will say, you are denied family visits for 4 months or something like that. So that's oftentimes what happens. Or they will actually deny the family on the basis that they're a security threat. So they will say, and usually this happens once their children turn 16, they will immediately be deemed a security threat, especially if it's a male child. So usually family members between the ages of 16 and 45 are not allowed to visit their family member in prison. Only the first degree family members are allowed to visit. So meaning like parents, siblings, children, and your wife or husband or wife. But there, you need to prove that you are related to this person. So there was one case that we had where they did not allow for, they allowed for the prisoner's grandparents to visit them, but not their grandchild that had just been born. So this was also a way to try to put pressure on the prisoner by denying them from this like very exciting and joyous moment of their first grandchild being born. And it was because they said that their grandchild was not considered a first degree relative. So only their child was considered, their son was considered a first degree relative, but not his children. So this is why this is one of the most important issues that prisoners have, is to be able to have these family visits. Now, many of the family members actually put the responsibility on the Red Cross as well, for because the Red Cross is responsible for coordinating these visits, and the families say that they don't do enough to actually help prisoner family members who are denied for security reasons. So this photo is actually taken in Ramallah at a demonstration that happens weekly at the Red Cross office of family members. They're all holding photos of their family member who is in prison. And they feel very frustrated that the ICRC is bowing down to Israel's pressure for not allowing them to have visits, to the point where families used to be allowed to have 2 visits a month for 45 minutes, and the ICRC reduced them to 1 visit a month for 45 minutes. So one of the demands is to reinstate having bi-monthly visits for an hour and a half each time, and to allow more than first degree family members to come, and to for the ICRC to actually remove this process of security of the security check on the family members, so that all family members would be able to visit. And the family visits are also used as a way to put as a form of collective punishment as well on prisoners. So, for example, in 2007, during the siege on Gaza, and in 2012, during every incursion on Gaza, basically in 2014 and 2009, all families are not allowed to visit from Gaza. So this is a form of collective punishment on them. While their families are being attacked and bombed and bombarded in Gaza, they're also not allowed to come and see their family members. So this is why this is one of their main and first demands. The second one is about medical negligence. So if you could go back, So in the prison, there's a lot of deliberate medical negligence, as well as negligence. Sorry. For example, many prisoners say that the prison clinic becomes a point of collusion and collaboration for the prisoner. So when a prisoner attempts to go get medical care from the clinic, they ask them to collaborate with them, to give them information on other people in their cell, to give them any other information, which actually deters prisoners from actually going to the clinic. So this is one of the ways that they cause a lot of medical issues to happen inside the prison, because people are afraid of being either asked to be a collaborator, or if they do go to the clinic, then perhaps their fellow prisoners will no longer trust them or will maybe find them suspicious. There's also a lot of intentional delay in treatment, malpractice, medical procedure errors, failure to diagnose, and lack of proficiency and efficiency. The prisoners do not trust the medical practitioners. They often have very basic medical experience. One ex-prisoner told me he never went to the clinic in the 30 years that he was in prison, because he said, look, underneath their white coat, they're wearing their soldier's uniform, so why would I go trust them with my life? And he told me many stories of how they would actually try to treat themselves in cases of, toothaches and things like that, to actually just avoid going to the clinic. So I want to give 2 cases of medical negligence to show how it's actually used as a tool against prisoners. So this is a photo of Maisara Abu Hamdiya, who died in prison in 2013 at the age of 61. Maisara had throat cancer for many, many years, and he was denied treatment. At first, they were just telling him nothing's wrong with you. They would just give him painkillers if he went to the clinic, or they would just deny him from going to the clinic as a form of punishment, Or they also only allow a certain number of prisoners to visit the clinic every week or every month. And so they have to make their own decisions on who needs the most urgent medical care. So sometimes he wouldn't make it to the list. And he ultimately, his cancer continued to get worse and worse and worse. Ultimately, they allowed him to actually go see a doctor 3 weeks before his death. They did not allow his family to come visit him. He continued to be shackled to his hospital bed the entire time, and he died alone from throat cancer because of medical negligence and because they refused to give him any kind of treatment. Maysara is one of at least 51 prisoners that have died from medical negligence inside the prison. This doesn't include those who have died from complications of issues that they contracted in prison that went untreated for years, or from those who died from complications from long-term hunger strikes after they had been released. And if you could show me the next slide. This is a poster of Thaer Halahle, who is another hunger striker. He went on a hunger strike a few years ago for 77 days because he was under administrative detention without charge and without trial. And during Thaer's interrogation, he had to get a dental procedure that was really urgent. And so they actually did a tooth extraction, but they used non-sterile tools, and so he contracted hepatitis from this procedure. Now, instead of the Israelis actually taking a responsibility for this and giving him treatment, they told him, "No, actually, you contracted it from your wife, because your wife has been cheating on you." And they tried to shame the entire family, and they forced his wife and his children to all get tested for hepatitis in order to prove that it was indeed from the prison. So this is also another tactic that's used on top of the medical negligence, is the utter humiliation of prisoners. And this was during his interrogation, and I didn't get a chance to talk about how horrific interrogation is, and torture, both physical and psychological torture, is used against prisoners in order to extract any kind of information from them. And so this was all happening during his interrogation as well. So improved medical care, in which prisoners can get health care outside of the prison clinic, is one of the demands for this hunger strike. To have routine care, to be able to get surgeries that they need by qualified professionals. And another thing is to also not have to pay for the medical treatment, because in cases when prisoners have been able to get medical treatment, they actually have to front the costs for the surgery or for the procedure that they need.
We're kind of running out of time a little bit, but I won't cut you off right now, but if you could just...
So the last thing I'll talk about is education. So one of the other, if you could go to two slides from now. I think it's just really important to bring in the stories of the people who we're actually fighting for. So this is why I go so far into depth in them. Okay, so this is Kefah Kuzmad. He's a senior at Birzeit University. A month ago, he was arrested. He went missing for several days. And then he was finally found in an interrogation center called the Russian Compound, which is one of the most difficult interrogation centers that Palestinians go through. Kefah was just put under administrative detention for 6 months, meaning he's being held without charge or trial indefinitely. This can be continued to be renewed. Kefah is a student activist. He's very outspoken. He's at all the, like, many protests. He speaks out against the occupation, against coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, which we could talk about later. And he's now currently in prison. He won't be able to graduate this semester as he had intended to. And this is the reality of many, many Palestinian students who are arrested in the middle of their semester, oftentimes during finals, and they are they're in prison for years and are not able to continue their education. So I just wanted to bring his case up to light. And it's often, I believe almost every single elected student body president has been arrested by the Israeli authorities. So this goes back to what you were saying about the youth and how they're trying to suppress the youth. In this case, in the case of university students, it's a very violent and direct way in which they actually round them up. They oftentimes go into the universities and raid the universities and take all their supplies and try to figure out who's in different political parties at the university to try to suppress any activity there. Because as we know, universities are where the resistance starts. I don't know if that's the case for Harvard, but I'm not sure. So the last point I want to make is one of their other key demands is actually to allow for continuing education inside the prisons, both for high school students and younger, and also to do university. Because in 2006, when an Israeli soldier was arrested in Gaza by Hamas, while the Israeli occupation forces were conducting a ground raid there, the prisoners faced a lot of punitive measures. And one of them, which is still in place today, is that they're not allowed to do any kind of formal education. So what their prisoners are asking for is to allow for education, allow for students to take their final exams, because a lot of child prisoners who are under the age of 18 actually end up dropping out after they go through the prison system, even if it's for a couple of months, because they get behind with their classmates and they don't want to start like the 10th grade over and over and over again. And this is another way that the Israeli occupation is trying to break the resistance, is by trying to not even allow us an education. So I'll stop there, but just by saying, actually in Boston on April 17th, we're going to have an event for Political Prisoners Day. It's taking place at the Park Street train station at 4 p.m.
You have been listening to Nadia Ben-Youssef and Rhonda Wabe speaking at a forum organized by the Palestine Solidarity Committee at Harvard University in the spring of 2017. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.